Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Maria Garcia. We're learning more today about the 11 people killed in that tragic shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh on Saturday. They ranged in age from 54 to 97. 8 were men, 3 were women. 2 of them, Cecil and David Rosenthal, ages 59 and 54, were brothers. Both lived in the Squirrel Hill neighborhood where the shooting took place. Another 2 victims, Bernice and Sylvan Simon, were a married couple in their 80s. Rose Malinger was the oldest victim. She was 97 years old. We have a link to all the names and remembrances up on our website, radioboston.org. White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders spoke to reporters in the last hour, condemning the attack.
This atrocity was a chilling act of mass murder. It was an act of hatred. And above all, it was an act of evil. Anti-Semitism is a plague to humanity, and it is responsible for many of the worst horrors in human history. We all have a duty to confront anti-Semitism in all its forms and everywhere and anywhere it appears.
The suspect, 46-year-old Robert Bowers, was arrested on Saturday and brought to court today, where he waived the reading of charges against him and was assigned a public defender. We're going to spend some time today on this story. And listeners, we want to hear from you on this as well. How are you reacting? Where do you turn for hope in moments like these? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And you can tweet us at Radio Boston. In a few minutes, we'll speak with a scholar of Jewish studies. But first, David Shribman, a longtime Bostonian, joins us from the offices of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, where he is the executive editor. David, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
First, you know, we want to express our condolences to people in Pittsburgh. We know this is a dark, difficult moment. This is your community. You live only 3 blocks from Tree of Life. Can you give us a sense of how you and people around you are wrestling with this violence today?
Well, people here now, Maria, are in the kind of situation you're in after a shocking death, in that you're pushing through with lots of things to do. In our case, we perform our mourning by doing our service through work. And so many others have the same situation. But what I worry about is when the work ends and the urgency subsides, and it really hits us that 11 of our neighbors have perished senselessly, horrifically, and violently, how we're all going to react. And I worry about my own family, and I worry about our community, my neighbors, and I, above all, worry about my colleagues here at the Post-Gazette.
Mm-hmm. There's no doubt this has surfaced some collective trauma. You know, in the Boston,
that's for sure.
Yeah, in the Boston Globe today, you quoted Stephen Wiseman, who wrote the most recent history of Judaism in America, and said that the fabric of American Judaism is woven into Squirrel Hill. Tell us more about what you call one of the most vital centers of Jewish identity since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution.
Well, first of all, unlike Boston and other places in the country, Jewish life did not migrate to the shiny, fresh suburbs, some of which, including the one I grew up in, Swampscott. Jewish life did not migrate to Lexington and Wellesley and Marblehead. It stayed, in our case, in Squirrel Hill, which is a neighborhood a little bit like Brookline, though substantially smaller and within the city limits of Pittsburgh. The county executive lives a block or two from Tree of Life and 3 or 4 blocks from me. Mike Tomlin, the coach of the Steelers, lives 2 blocks from Tree of Life. Mm. Most poignantly, Mr. Rogers grew up right there and lived right there. Mm-hmm. Well, but there's more. If you don't mind, I'll go on. Pittsburgh is really one of the founding places, if not the founding place, of Reform Judaism. It's where it's the Pittsburgh Platform was written in the 19th century. It's where the great debates about music and organs in Jewish ceremonies began. It's the site of where William Howard Taft gave a remarkable speech at Road of Shalom, which is right around the corner from, well, around two corners maybe, from Tree of Life. It is one of the centers of Jewish life, much like Blue Hill Avenue in Boston might have been two generations ago.
Well, you write about the irony that what some people are calling the most deadly attack on Jewish Americans in modern history happened in what you consider the least anti-Semitic city in the country. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, sure. I mean, I've lived in lots of places. I've lived in Boston and Washington and Buffalo and here and in New Hampshire. And, you know, I've loved all those places. I have great affection for them all. But this is the only place where I've seen that it is very comfortable and easy to be Jewish for Jews and for Catholics and Protestants and Muslims and others who are very accepting, not only accepting, of welcoming. It's unremarkable that somebody is Jewish in this community. It's totally unremarkable to see people walking down the street, you know, dressed in the garb of the Orthodox and the very observant. It's completely unremarkable for the rabbi and the bishop to go together on a single trip to both Jerusalem and to Rome. And in my own case, I have a Catholic wife. I'm Jewish. Mm. We go together, my wife, Catholic wife, and her Jewish husband, and I, and the rabbi, to Midnight Mass, where the bishop, in his recessional, will stop and give us all a hug. Mm. That doesn't happen everywhere.
Well, I do want to hear from Rabbi Jeffrey Myers of Tree of Life Synagogue talking about the tragedy today.
We are a tree of life. You can cut off some branches from our tree, but Tree of Life has been in Pittsburgh for 154 years. We're not going anywhere. I will not let hate close down my building.
Hmm. I know so many of us are still asking this, David, but I wonder if you can share your thoughts. Do you see this violence as a reflection of hateful political rhetoric that's built up, or has it been stoked by it or instigated by it or both?
You know, I don't know whether it is a reflection of or a cause of. I do know that they exist in coexistence. I do know that this is at base a political question. And here's how I'm looking at this right now. In a city that's grieving and that's hurt, and I'm looking out across the Monongahela, Ohio, and Allegheny Rivers and all the flags that have mast. This is next week we have elections, and that's a time for politics. This week we have funerals, and that's a time for remembrance, for regret, for memories, and to bury our dead.
Well, David Shribman, executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, joins us live from Pittsburgh. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
The thanks go to you. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you. And just a reminder to our listeners, you can find a link to the names of the victims and what we know about them on our website, radioboston.org. Well, the shock and grief following the shooting in Pittsburgh have reverberated across the nation, including here in Boston. Hundreds of people gathered on the Boston Common yesterday for a vigil to mourn the 11 lives lost. Among them was Boston University student Ariel Stein, who's from Pittsburgh and attends the Tree of Life Synagogue. Here she is speaking at the vigil.
A year ago, I traveled to Auschwitz with some students from Boston University. I learned all about the struggles of the Holocaust, about anti-Semitism, and never would I think that my community would be the face of such an act. But it is up to all of us to love each other, to want to love one another, and to stand up for the other in society.
To hear more about how the local community is reacting and to put this tragedy into the larger context of the growing anti-Semitism that we're seeing across the country and intolerance, we turn to Susanna Heschel. She's a professor of Jewish studies at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire, and she joins me in the studio. Hello, Susanna.
Hello.
Thanks so much for joining us. This is obviously a very emotional moment. We thank you for your time. And I know you're struggling, as are so many people. What's racing through your head at this time?
I feel as though this act has changed our experience of being Jewish in the United States entirely. As a professor of modern Jewish history, I have to say that I will not teach modern Jewish history in the same way any longer. We had thought it was different in this country, and we're discovering that we hadn't realized this undertone, this massive, actually, undertone in this country of neo-Nazis, of white nationalism, and so forth, that they would come to the fore and attack us, that there would be essentially a pogrom in America.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, experts say that the conspiracy theories, the hateful rhetoric surrounding anti-Semitism, you know, they're now being circulated by establishment sources, right? By, in some cases, some say dog whistles by government sources, giving them sort of a false sheen of legitimacy. What do you think about that?
I think that's very true. I've heard a lot of people debate whether President Trump has actually tried to arouse white nationalists and anti-Semites and racists in this country. But the issue to me isn't what his intention may or may not be. We don't know that. I don't know if he knows that even. That's irrelevant. The point is that there are people out there, these so-called white nationalists, who hate Jews, who hate black people, who hate Muslims, and so forth. And they're hearing a message loud and clear from President Trump. The point is, there is responsibility that each human being has to take for the impact of our words, how they are heard, what the resonance is, what are the effects of this? And this has to stop.
Mm-hmm. So I know that you have relatives who belong to the synagogue. I can't imagine learning of the news and wondering about your relatives. What has been the last, what have the last couple of days been like for you?
The last couple of days have been days of shock and horror and despair and terrible depression. It is Tree of Life, but it's also what this represents. Antisemitism has existed for 2,000 years, and we never thought that it would be called up in this way. That it exists as a rhetoric, as a passion for some people, we thought we could tamp it down. We thought that the United States provided a democratic society, a liberal society of tolerance. And this is what's been called into question now.
Mm-hmm. The Anti-Defamation League has cited a 57% rise in anti-Semitic incidents in the U.S. since 2017, including bomb threats, assaults, vandalism, hateful speech. You know, this is shocking, but at the same time, not surprising, especially considered what's happened in Charlottesville and churches in Charleston and Sutherland Springs in recent years. I want to listen to, again, Rabbi Jeffrey Myers of Tree of Life Synagogue talking about the tragedy today.
I never thought this could happen in my synagogue, ever. I just never thought it could reach this level that someone would take into their own hands and make a decision that they needed to murder Jews.
Hmm. What do you make of the rise of white supremacy and neo-Nazism emerging in the country, Susanna?
This is terribly frightening. It's a terribly frightening time for all Jews, but I think it's a frightening time for all people. You know, when the election took place of President Trump, people said, now you know what it's like to live as a black person in the United States, how it is to live with this, with fear, and with the kind of rhetoric that is so ugly, frightening rhetoric. So, yes, when this happened, of course, what was on my mind was Charleston and the murder there and that black church and all the many black churches that have been burned down by arson attacks throughout this country. I thought also of Bishop Romero murdered in El Salvador. The idea of killing people at worship is especially horrifying because we have a sense that we all want to live lives of dignity, live in a civilized world. And if there's one moment when we're excused from anger, from hatred, one moment when we can be vulnerable, mm-hmm. it's when we are at prayer. Mm-hmm. Prayer is that place of refuge in which we have our full humanity. Mm. So the attack is an attack on what it is to be a human being.
Mm. I want to go back to this idea that you were talking about earlier about the difference in impact versus intentions, right? And yes. that it doesn't matter, you say, what the president intends to say, but what matters is the impact. Now, we just heard at the top of this hour a strong statement from the White House press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, condemning this act. The president also spoke out strongly against anti-Semitism earlier. We should remember his daughter is married to a Jewish man. Do you feel that the White House has responded appropriately?
To issue a statement is a very easy thing to do. It's like sending a birthday card to an acquaintance or a friend. The issue is the friendship all year long, not just the birthday card. So fine, the White House issued a statement condemning anti-Semitism. Good for them. That's not the point. The point is assuming responsibility, and not just 100% responsibility, but even going beyond the minimum requirement and stopping this kind of language. And we've heard it over and over again, the vulgarity issued from this man, this president. Now, let me also, if I may, make another point, which is there is no quid pro quo when it comes to anti-Semitism. We don't excuse one statement because we have something else under the table that's handed to us. In other words, I heard, in fact, on the radio this morning, a man calling in and saying, well, President Trump recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, therefore he can't be anti-Semitic. And his daughter converted to Judaism and married a Jew, his grandchildren Jewish, so forth. That's not an excuse for anything. There is no quid pro quo. That is, I don't care if he moved the embassy to Jerusalem or didn't move it. What I care about is the Jews shouldn't be murdered.
You know, you teach Jewish studies at Dartmouth College. How will this change the way you teach? How does this change the narrative of being Jewish in America?
This changes the narrative entirely. I must tell you that when I teach modern Jewish history and I talk about the Dreyfus Affair in France and the pogroms in Russia, and I talk about the rise of Nazism and the Holocaust, and then I come to the United States, and it's a different story. The United States, the place of refuge, United States, where nothing like this could happen. The right. difference, the American difference. Although I've also taught an article by my colleague, Tony Michaels, in which he argues that, in fact, it's not so different. But I have to say he's right. It's not so different. I can't talk about it as different any longer. Antisemitism isn't kept from our shores. We are not protected because we have oceans around us. In the United States. That's what's frightening, and that will change. And we have to understand that anti-Semitism is not a product of a given country or a particular political movement. It can be taken up by any political movement, left wing, right wing, it doesn't matter, and used with such gruesome brutality. That's what's shocking. How available it is, so easily available.
Professor of Holocaust History at Emory University, Deborah Lipstadt, likened anti-Semitism to a herpes infection that lies dormant and then reemerges at times of stress. Does that resonate for you?
Yes, it does. I've thought about it as termites. If you live in a house, you don't even know you have termites. And then you open a door, you lift a piece of wood in your basement, and there they are. Yes, it's a kind of infection that can undermine the foundation of a society, and that's what's important.
Okay. Susanna Herschel, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Also today, U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions was in Boston talking about the future of religious liberty, an event sponsored by the Lawyers Chapter of the Federalist Society. WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks was there. And Anthony, I gather the Attorney General addressed the shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue over the weekend. Tell us what he said.
Yes, he did. So Sessions was here to talk about efforts by the Trump administration to bring and win court cases in support of religious freedom, as they say. And he said, given what happened over the weekend, this couldn't come at a more important time. Here's a bit of what he said.
We're still reeling today from the murderous rampage in Pittsburgh that took the life of 11 congregants targeted because of their faith, worshiping faithfully in their own synagogue. This was not just an attack on the Jewish faith. It was an attack on all people of faith.
Sessions called this an attack on America's values and said it cannot and will not be tolerated. So he more or less reiterated what the president said on Saturday when President Trump called the attack pure evil.
So Anthony, Sessions' appearance was scheduled before the attack to talk about the future of religious freedom. And I understand he was confronted by some religious leaders here in Boston.
Yeah, and it was pretty dramatic. So just as Sessions was beginning his remarks, Will Green, a Methodist minister from Andover who was in the audience, stood up and confronted him, reciting and then referring to verses from the Bible. Here's a bit of that confrontation.
I was a stranger, and you did not welcome me.
Thank you for your comments. And,
and you did not visit me. Brother Jeff, as a fellow United Methodist, I call upon you to repent, to care for those in need.
Well, thank you for those remarks and attack, but I will just tell you we do our best every day to fulfill my responsibility to enforce the laws of the United States.
Now, as police escorted Minister Green out of the room, another minister, a Baptist minister, Darrell Hamilton, stood up and continued the protest. You could hear people in the audience there yelling to him, go home. He, too, was escorted out by the police. So it was an eventful morning for Mr. Sessions in Boston. But after that disruption, he was able to deliver his remarks.
So give us a sense of what he had to say.
So Sessions was here to talk about what's really become a conservative rallying cry. And the way the Trump administration phrases this is a commitment to religious freedom. He talked about the Department of Justice's Religious Freedom Task Force, which Sessions established as part of an effort by the Trump administration to identify instances where religious freedom is under assault in their view. And here's a bit of what Sessions said.
We've witnessed the ordeal still ongoing faced by the Colorado baker who simply doesn't want the government to force him to create art that offends his religious beliefs. Why don't they just leave him alone?
So this is a key example of what Sessions talked about today. In that case, the Colorado Civil Rights Commission had ruled against the baker, saying he had discriminated against the gay couple. But the baker argued that it violated his religious rights to be forced to create that cake for the gay couple. And the case went all the way to the Supreme Court, which sided with the bakers. And Sessions says this is the kind of case that his Department of Justice is committed to successfully prosecute.
Hmm. Now, the Alliance Defending Freedom was also a big part of this event. Give us some context. Who is this group?
Right. So Sessions was introduced by Jordan Lawrence of the Alliance Defending Freedom. Now, this is a conservative Christian nonprofit group with the stated goal of advocating, training, and funding on the issues of religious freedom, sanctity of life and marriage and family. It's committed to the idea of religious liberty. It's pro-Trump in a big way, but its views are also controversial. The Southern Poverty Law Center, for example, has designated it as a hate group because, among other things, it has supported efforts to recriminalize homosexuality. That said, Sessions made the point that this cause, conservative defense of religious freedom, is gaining traction. He established a so-called Religious Liberty Task Force in the DOJ, and he said neutral umpiring in the courts is ascendant, while what he called liberal activism and ideology are on the defensive.
It's a stunning reversal. And so thanks to the president, President Trump, there are two more Federalist Society members of the United States Supreme Court.
And Maria, as you might expect, that statement earned a round of applause from the members of the Lawyers Chapter of the Federalist Society here in Boston.
All right, that's WBUR's senior political reporter, Anthony Brooks. Thanks so much, Anthony.
My pleasure.
All right, stay with us. Coming up, for the fourth time since 2004, the Red Sox are World Series champions. I'm Maria Garcia. This is Radio Boston.